This is Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Austin Wintry. And hey, it is so great to have a chance to talk with you.
The pleasure's mine, and I greatly appreciate your patience since you reached out, I think, approximately 200 years ago. And we've been kind of in a email phone tag. The fact that we would meet, you know, face to face at a concert before being on the show, despite starting that conversation ages ago, is a testament to your patience. So thank you for that.
Well, you know, it's a fine line between being a pest and being patient.
but it's never a pest. Believe me, I'm very grateful that you would even have the interest. So to me, the idea of being a pest over, you know, please let's chat about your work, it's like, how could one be anything except deeply flattered about that? So no, I appreciate it.
Well, one of the things that really strikes me, and we can start this way, because I was talking with my son. He's a designer. And the other day he was telling me where he was in the game that he was playing. He was about to explore an insane asylum with a scientist that he had just met who was wearing power armor. And they were going to clear out some mutant zombies with a laser rifle. And we just laughed because that's like every cliche in the book for games. And the
sounds
games,
like he was playing Fallout.
It was Fallout. Yeah. And so that really struck me, both of us really, because of so many of the cliches and the games that you've been doing lately, Journey and the Banner Saga and now Abzu, just really fill a vacuum because there are so few games really like that.
Yeah, it's you know, there's happily more and more. All the time, you know, like just this year, for example, Firewatch was a big hit. And in an era of, you know, laser rifle, zombie hunting games, I think, by the way, ghouls is probably more accurate than zombies if we're talking Fallout.
Yeah, for sure.
Just, you know, to keep our street cred here. But yeah, I don't know. It felt a lot more novel, for example, 10 years ago when we did Flow, that game company's first title, which started as a student project, than now. And I'm thrilled about that. You know, the fact that so many games are exploring the boundaries of what we define a game to even be is a very, very welcome sort of paradigm shift, or at least the beginnings of a paradigm shift. I remember the way Genova put it, the creative director from that game company, was that he looked at, in fact, you heard me say this at the concert, so forgive me for repeating myself, but he said, if you look at like a color wheel of, you know, like when you're setting your computer settings and you can drag the cursor over this kind of full representation of the color spectrum, he said, you know, what emotions, if we see this as an analogy to the emotional spectrum, you know, to the range of possibilities that humans experience emotionally, then virtually all games fall in that kind of bright red and orange territory of excitement and adrenaline and often outright just testosterone and masculinity and all these things. And he said, you know, why is that, though? That's ridiculous. I want to make games that explore this full range, you know, games that are quiet and introspective and games that are, you know, like sad, but not sad in some conventional or obvious sense, but, you know, mature notions of reflection that as you go through life change with you. And in the same way that a great work of art that you engage in as a kid that you then revisit as an adult, not only is it just as or more resonant later, but for entirely new reasons now. That kind of thing, that was his goal. And at the time it was like, through video games? And now it's like, you know, I look at that and I think, games are the perfect medium for this because the definition is so much broader than just about any other medium, that our ability to expand that tent is enormous, you know, because Tetris and The Last of Us are both games, for example. And I don't know that you can make that kind of claim, like X and Y are both movies where they are as different from each other as, you know, Tetris and The Last of Us. And likewise for any manner of literature, you know, theater, I think, has a bit of a gamut, because sitting at a in a play is very different than going to, say, Sleep No More. But they're still a lot more like each other, I think, than within the internal framework of games, Tetris and The Last of Us are. And to me, that is really amazing, because I think that means that as the 21st century continues to unfold, our spectrum of games is just going to continue to kind of exponentially widen. And that's, you know, it's incredibly exciting to be a part of that.
Oh, I
can't. So anyway, I don't even remember what your question was, because I just kind of rambled off into some random direction.
Well, no, but and it's fascinating, because I think the game industry has matured enough now that there is definitely an embrace. People are embracing these kinds of games. And you touched on theater, and this concert that we've mentioned a couple times, but not specifically, was Journey Live. And that was just the most incredible experience, because it really did touch on all these different things. It's got the emotion that's in the game, plus the thrill of a live performance. And so it really kind of maybe indicates the direction that games can go with the right kind of material.
Well, what do you mean specifically by that when you say the way they can go?
Well, just that games for many, many people are kind of a solitary experience. And
I see.
And having the shared experience of an audience, I mean, granted, it wasn't a huge audience in that particular venue, but to have everybody there, you're kind of bringing their own experiences, because clearly a lot of them had already played the game many, many times. But to see it in that context with the live performance was just a completely new experience.
Yeah, and I think the idea of it being something that can expand beyond, you know, the simple origins of Journey Live. I mean, but you know, just as a testament to that, for example, I just saw on Twitter the other day, Jessica Curry is doing effectively Dear Esther Live.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, by analogy, the folks at Sony did the big God of War reveal at E3. As a live, you know, orchestra overlapping with gameplay thing as well. And even going back further than that, you know, years ago, I remember one of the first video games live shows I ever went to that Tommy Tallarico hosts and produces, someone played like Frogger or
I remember that.
Or, you know, Space Invaders or something like, I think it actually was Space Invaders, because they put on this shirt that had a sensor in it and they ran back and forth left and right across the edge of the stage, and it was actually moving the ship on screen, you know, sort of in parallel to their physical movement. And they had, I think, some kind of button where they were actually shooting. So the controller was basically their body while the orchestra accompanied them. And so it's like, again, tip of the iceberg of the possibilities here.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we are just so excited about the release of Abzu. You and I are talking about it before the game has been released, and there's just so much excitement about it. It must have been so much fun at E3 to get all of that love and just, you know, the feedback from people who had played it.
Yeah, E3 kind of blew me away, because they set up this crazy booth that was like a giant human fish tank, and I did not know they were going to do that. That was an aggressive move on their part. And but yeah, I am excited. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, I've worked on a wide variety of games. I'm really thrilled for the diversity I've had in my career, from very eccentric and wonderful games like Monaco to, you know, games that are hard to put a specific label on, like the Banner Saga, and then of course, you know, much more kind of earnestly AAA titles like Assassin's Creed Syndicate, and the sliver to which I contributed to Jason on The Order, for example, but through all that are titles like Flow, Journey, and now Abzu, and you could even include in a sort of the same breath the game I did with Tell of Tales called Sunset, where they are just outright trying to do something different, and I feel so grateful to be someone who gets sort of the call not infrequently for folks who are trying to make those kinds of games. you know, to push those boundaries. In fact, one of those calls that I got I was unavailable to work on at the time, which in hindsight has just become heartbreaking, was Monument Valley. And made by some real good friends of mine, particularly a guy named Ken Wong, who was you know, one kind of the lead designer, I believe is the accurate title, designer and artist. But that's another kind of one where I'm like, ah, man, that's just, those are the kinds of games I want to see exist in the world alongside your Assassin's Creeds and your Fallouts and games like that.
Well, sure, and because there is such a huge spectrum of games, and I think what's interesting about Abzu is that it's not really tied to a particular place or a particular era, so that must have given you a lot of freedom with the music.
It does, although I will say, when games are a very prescriptive about their time and place and era and whatnot, I don't really consider that a constraint either, because using Assassin's Creed Syndicate as the obvious example there, that game takes place in the 1860s in London. It's, you know, Victorian London, cusp of the Industrial Revolution. There is quite a lot there that is theoretically defining your time and place for you. But I did not really factor any of that into the music, because to me, it's redundant to try to make the score feel, quote, Victorian, because the game is already feeding us plenty of its various Victorianisms that are relevant. I care far more about the characters. Now, the degree to which the music can dovetail with that sense of, like, you know, periodicity, you could almost say, is kind of bonus. And I would say that the people that consider that score to sound, you know, very Victorian or feel very kind of neo-romantic or neoclassical, I say, awesome, that's great. I love that it dovetails in that way. But that was not the goal. The goal of that kind of language, which I jokingly refer to as Neo-Mendelssohn, it was because I wanted something that felt light on its feet and something that felt like it moved with that almost cat-like dexterity like characters like Legolas do. And because to me, that's what the assassins embody. That's what they are like. They move with extreme ease and fluidity. And so this idea of chamber music that can just pivot left and right is, with, you know, in a way that's vastly more nimble than the lumbering but otherwise impressive forces of a large orchestra. That was what drew me there. That was the interest. And in fact, if we really want to be sort of more specific about it, it's not actually musicologically Victorian at all. It's the joke was, I went back in time and abducted Mendelssohn and brought him about 80 years into the future, 90 years, to hang out with Bartok for a while, then sent him back so that he didn't fully lose touch with his own era, but he was writing in a harmonic vocabulary far beyond that of his time. So it's one of those where, you know, because it's a chamber ensemble, you know, of strings primarily playing music that has that specific light on its feet quality, you can't help but say, oh, this is, I guess, a little bit Victorian sounding, or a little bit mid 19th century sounding, but in truth, it's actually more like mid 20th century in its harmonic vocabulary. None of which actually mattered to me. So, a game like Abzu, the approach or journey or anything else, the approach is exactly identical to that. I say, what actually matters about this game? Well, obviously in Assassin's Creed Syndicate, what matters to me primarily are the characters and what motivates them. And Abzu, much like Journey, is far more metaphorical than that. So the characters are intentionally more like blank slates that the player is hopefully going to imprint themselves or imprint other ideas onto. So I'm not trying to create a musical conviction of who that character is so much as add to the foundation on which the player can stand to bring their own ideas to it, if that makes any sense at all.
Well, it does. And the thing that's really struck me as I've watched the gameplay for Abzu is how fluid it is, because there's no gravity. It just, there's this joy of being underwater and exploring without the things that would tie us down, like gravity or even sounds that you'd hear on land. And so it seems, sure, it seems as though your music kind of really, really supports that too, that freedom and just the joy of movement underwater.
Yeah, that's the hope. You know, you know, there's a few thoughts going into that that Matt Nava and the developers at Giant Squid had, which were that, you know, first off, it's not a scuba simulator, as Matt likes to say. It's about the dream of scuba diving. It's about what we, you know, what it's more like to be able to just breathe underwater and to just move freely. And because, you know, the game doesn't have things like depth gauges and air tank readouts showing you, you know, oh, I have to surface or I'm going to drown, the way real scuba diving, relaxing and amazing though it is, and I'm also a diver like Matt, you know, there's a lot of wonderful things about diving, but you obviously have to closely monitor your gear just to avoid death. And none of that has any bearing in Abzu whatsoever. But one step further than that is to the point that you just made. Most games that have any kind of water environment, like water levels in platformers and things like that, that tends to be the worst level because it tends to be so difficult to make the mechanics feel right. It ends up just being annoying and tedious. And so Matt, in an effort to make it under an aquatic game that captured his particular dream about scuba diving in particular, looked more at flying games and flight simulators to really hone in on the mechanics and the way the camera should move and all that, so that you get that real sense of fluidity. And like you said, almost zero gravity, and it just feels free. All of this is coming in kind of a response to working on Journey for 3 years, where he felt like, you know, the goal was to make an environment completely devoid of life and sort of positive lifey feedback. As a direct purpose, as a direct function of what Journey's point was. This has the opposite. This is a game that's just supposed to be overwhelming and overflowing with life and, you know, beautiful energy. So that obviously ties in really nicely with the kind of feeling of liberation of flight. And so that obviously all fed into the score as well.
Well, how did you know where to start? You'd mentioned that when Genova was talking with you about Journey, you got the idea for the main theme right away, like on your way to your car. Did the same thing happen with Abzu?
Not quite, but nearly. Matt showed me, before he really told me what the game was going to be, I remember him just emailing me some drawings that he'd been making. And he sent me this piece of concept art that showed a diver clearly underwater, as there were, it was in kind of an underwater cave and there were jellyfish floating around. But the diver was standing what looked like a stream, indicating that there was some kind of heavier water or some other non-water but fluid substance there. Because it was one of those that, if you looked at a glance, it just looked like it was a cave and there was a little stream. And then you notice the jellyfish and you think, oh, well, maybe those are, you know, some kind of air-based floating jellyfish or something. And then you notice, well, wait, no, there's also a character standing in this cave that's wearing a dive suit. And there were these other indications that, you know, I think what I'm looking at is an aquatic environment that has some kind of other kind of magic water at the bottom that's got its own sort of independent set of fluid dynamics. And that was just so evocative to me because it immediately asked all these questions. And to me, that's kind of the hallmark of great art, you know, is rather than telling me things, it asks questions. And this was a perfect example. And Matt's work is always like that. I mean, when we were working on Journey, we had kind of mutual man crushes on each other, I think, because his art so deeply informed my music. And he often said that it was the other way around for him. Which brings to mind a kind of paradox of, well, where did it start? you know, like the watch and Somewhere in Time, where did it come from? And in any case, he showed me this and I immediately was kind of transfixed. And then not long after, he said, okay, so I've decided to start my own. I've left that game company. I've started my own company and we're going to make a game and I'm putting the team together and I'd like to tell you about it and hope that you'll work on it with me, which of course he didn't need to even tell me what the pitch was. I would work with him again, no matter what he was up to, because he's, you know, one of my heroes. But as soon as he did start telling me about the ideas and the visual language and the emotional language, I was hooked. And so I started playing around with ideas and was able to, I actually sat on it for a long time before I sent it to him because I wasn't 100% convinced that it was right, which is different from like Journey and the Banner Saga, where I sent it back straight away and we all seemed to agree immediately. This definitely was different from that for some reason. I was not convinced, but in the end I ended up not changing it. So it was, that was it. You know, that ended up being the piece, the theme, which later when he explained to me the origin of the word Abzu, which comes from this sort of Mesopotamian myth, the Enuma Elish, which is the world's oldest creation myth. It's a pillar, a stone pillar with this inscription on it in Akkadian, which is kind of the language of ancient Babylonia, referring to Abzu and Tiamat and the creation of the world at the meeting of kind of the ocean and the river. I just followed suit and named this theme To Know Water. And off we went, and a 3-year kind of adventure began.
It's amazing the layers of sound that you have in there, and I even was sort of struck in the choral writing. It sounded a little bit medieval, almost like Hildegard of Bingen or the Notre Dame school, just for a second there. But
well, so Hildegard von Bingen is I absolutely Hildegard of Bingen, we'll be American, is absolutely one of my favorites of this kind of medieval. I mean, you know, it's almost cliche at this point to love her writing. It's kind of like saying, what bands do you like? Oh, well, I really love the Beatles. But the Beatles are the Beatles for the same reason that she is who she is, because there's this incredible timelessness to her writing. In fact, I did a movie a number of years ago called Leave, where I based my main theme on one of her sort of chants, I guess you would call it, you know, a melody taken from something I'd heard of hers. And I just outright made it. I mean, I tweaked it, but it was essentially wholesale, or whole cloth rather, the theme to this film, but for a very specific reason, because of what that film was saying. And so I've had a long running love of her work, and I really love the purity. You know, when I give a lot of talks, well, I started saying I really love the purity of that kind of medieval and Renaissance singing, and the choral writing and the kind of melismatic and very decorative nature of it has this wonderful angularity. You know, we live in a world, for example, one of my private teachers in college was Morten Lauritsen.
Wow.
And his work obviously has this lush kind of ethereal quality to it that's perfect for these grand cathedrals and venues like that, where you have 9 hours of reverb and it's just this huge blanket that surrounds you. But what I really love about that earlier choral writing is that there's so much detail in it that if you were to perform it in an overly sort of wet environment, you actually would lose a lot of that. And so it's something that lends itself to slightly more intimate environments, for lack of a better way to put it. And so I have a long running love of that and hadn't had much occasion to write that way. And there's material, especially towards the end of Abzu, that, for the sake of avoiding spoilers, I take total ownership over that, of that kind of the choral writing of like Yama de Macho and Dupre and this late medieval, early Renaissance kind of turning point.
Yeah, I was totally picking up on that. There's something about the harmonies and just the interplay of the voices that it just really struck me in that particular piece, but then in also some of the others that I've been lucky enough to listen to. And
that's the hope. And you've not heard, the choir, I will say, the choir functions structurally in Abzu almost exactly the way the orchestra did in Journey, which is that it's this emergent property, so that by the end of the game, as people finish the game, they will probably come to the conclusion this was a very choir-heavy score. But they will have been deceived, because what they have gotten are a series of successive hints where the choir shows up for first just a measure and then three measures, and always in the background and always very textural and then slightly accompanimental. But then by the time you reach the end, it steps into the forefront and becomes so much the focus point that it's the last thing you remember, and therefore you think, that hopefully if it makes a sufficient impression, you never know, one hopes, it makes you think, wow, that was a very choir rich score, when in reality it's actually not. It's kind of a sleight of hand. Journey is not an orchestra-heavy score at all. It's only the last third of the game where I really lay the orchestra on thick, and it's really only the end where it becomes what I would consider orchestral. But those hints throughout make the orchestra hopefully feel inevitable, so that when it does come forward, you think, oh, this was always where this was going to go. And that's how I thought of the choir in Abzu as well. It is the inevitable destination point of this music, such that by the end, it just seems like it's choral, because we were always going to end up here.
Wow. Well, and along the way, you've got some gorgeous writing for the winds, especially the oboe. It just really shines out like a little beam of sunshine, really, throughout the mix. And the oboist... Well, the oboist, Kristen, she's phenomenal. Have you worked with her before?
Well, yes and no, because I started working with her on Abzu so long ago that we've done other things together in the interim, but this was the thing that I first reached out to her over 3 years ago. So Kristen Nagus is her name, and she has a YouTube channel and Facebook page and whatnot and Twitter that are under the moniker of Field of Reeds. And she's a professional oboist. She lives in Florida. She plays in orchestras, Orlando and area and whatnot in the area. And but she's also very tech savvy and records herself at home. And also she does these incredible arrangements where she'll feature the oboe, but then she'll use samples to create, an orchestra accompanying herself, and she's quite good at it. And so I first discovered her because she did a cover of Journey on English horn that she just put on YouTube, and I thought, this is astounding. It's absolutely, it's beautiful playing. It's a beautiful arrangement. It's well mixed. You know, it was all very top notch. And then she proceeded to cover several other things that I wrote, and I just thought, well, who is this person? I want to know this kind and generous soul who's taking all this time and putting all this energy into my work, but also doing such a good job of it. And so I love to feature, sort of in parallel to all that, when I'm starting a new score, I very often like to feature some kind of solo instrument that I think of as kind of the lead actor of the score. If what I'm writing is a script, who is my star? And obviously on a score like Journey, the cello played by Tina Guo is that star. Mm-hmm. And on Assassin's Creed, for example, there are two stars that are deliberately corresponding to the two twin assassins that you play as, Jacob and Evie Fry. And those two musicians are Sandy Cameron on violin and again, Tina Guo on cello, respectively. And so when starting this, for reasons that I don't actually really know, there is no kind of intellectualized reason for this. I just thought oboe needs to be the star of Absu. It was just one of those things that just as that melody hit me, it came in the form of an oboe melody. And I don't know what else to tell you other than that. And so I just said to her, hey, I would like to send a proof of concept of this melody to the team. And rather than use samples, would you like to record it? And so she was like, oh, sure, and which I was thrilled about. And so I sent it over to her, and she sent me back the recording. And much like when you listen to Nascence and you hear the cello at the very beginning and then the bass flute that comes in shortly thereafter, mm-hmm. I recorded those that first day. And then at the end of Nascence, they get joined by this lush string orchestra. Well, that orchestra was recorded 2.5 years later.
Wow.
Because it, you know, you wait to record your biggest elements until you're sure they're done, and you record them all at once. So 3 years worth of built up accrued music on Journey was all recorded at the very end, but that included cues that were literally almost 3 years old that had subcomponents that had been recorded at the very beginning. And in this piece, Nascence is the most extreme example of this, where the flute and oboe had been literally tracked years earlier, now we're being accompanied by an orchestra. The exact same thing happened on Absu. When you listen to No Water, that is the recording that Kristen did originally of this piece as a proof of concept for me to be able to just play them something that I felt better represented the theme than just relying on samples. And since it's easy to just track her, plus it was a way to kind of see what the workflow would be like and to just get to know her a little bit better, and to see also how she was miking it. Since she's in Florida and I'm here, I wanted to make sure that since I can't be there to physically engineer it myself or hire an engineer, I wanted to make sure that just technically it was going to be satisfactory, all of which, of course, it was. And so then once again, here we have, you know, the choir and the harp ensemble and the orchestra and all the elements that went into Absu accompanying her, which we recorded in April of this year, mm-hmm. but her solo was recorded solidly 2 years before that. And so it's kind of one of those funny you know, it's funny how that worked out exactly the same way on this one as it did on Journey. And it's a such a very 21st century kind of concept that you would have these elements that are just literally years separate from one another.
Yeah, I know, like unbound from time and space, because you can just bring them all together again. And it just really illustrates, I think, the kind of the magic that's possible with, as you say, with modern technology. And the other thing I was wondering about, because these are live recordings, but you could conceivably do the whole thing with samples. But are there ever any surprises or moments that kind of you're not expecting when you're working with an orchestra with the music that you know so well? Do they, I don't know, do a different spin on it than you weren't really expecting?
Always yes. They always will play. I mean, from a practical level, part of my job, especially when I'm conducting them, is to mitigate some of those surprises, because sometimes those surprises are things that you don't intend. You know, like that's classic one would be balance issues, right? You know, like I wrote a double stop and it just resonated on the strings on the violins, say, more than I anticipated. So they clobbered the violas. Samples obviously never had that problem, but I always treat the samples with a grain of salt, and I don't put much time into making my mock-ups, especially on a game like this where I have a lot of trust from the developers and they are not signing off on a cue based on the quality of the mock-up, but based on, you know, the idea that, yeah, this feels about right, and we just know it's going to sound better when it's live, and we trust you in that transition between those two elements, which is a really nice position to be in, by the way. So as a result, you know, the mock-up is never meant to, I definitely do not write for orchestra in the hope of recapturing the mock-up, because I've been lucky enough to work so much with orchestras throughout my entire life that I'm always writing for what the end product is going to sound like, and not trying to determine what that is through the mock-up process. But inevitably there are those little things that come up where it's like, oh, you know what? Sorry guys, I undermarked this, or I overmarked this. That forte really should be mezzo piano or something like that, back and forth. But then of course there are more creative things that come up as well, where I'll hear the way someone's playing something and I'll say, oh, you know, I think that we could exploit this further. We can go deeper with this. Let's try that. Or let's try, you know, like working with the choir. Could we try this with a lot more vibrato than you are doing? Because I think it's going to do X, Y, and Z. And because I just heard a little tease of something that's possible. And then, of course, there are other things where in the mock-ups, I'll write things that I know I just can't get until I'm with the orchestra. And so then I've been waiting to hear it for, in some cases, years. And a classic example for me is, being the softy that I am, I always love when there's a great big upward leap in the strings, that we put a nice big fat portamento on that, so that instead of this, you know, ba ba, it's some ba nya. And I love those sweeps, but the samples don't really do that convincingly at all. And to try to even hope to make them do that is an enormous amount of time spent programming that I just refuse to waste on. And so as soon as I'm there with the orchestra, I'll turn to the concertmaster, turn to whatever section to apply to, and say, you know, okay, bar three, just ham that up. Just be Alfred Newman's Fox Orchestra for me for a moment, and absolutely give me a big sweep into that. And so those are moments that they're not happy accidents, they're by design, but I also have not heard them until that moment, because the samples just don't do that. I've only imagined it and planned for it, and I've, you know, in some cases, you know, marked the parts fully anticipating that we are going to do it. But you know, sometimes it's also just, as soon as I hear them play, I think it's missing something. Oh, you know what? It's missing a portamento, or it's missing a mute, or it's missing I wrote a mute and I realized, no, it's missing the fullness of sound, and I should have put it in a mute, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of which is coming as a result of just being in the room with them in that moment.
Yeah, well, it's so cool that you can have that collaboration, because I think it gives a real sense of real people are doing this. Real people are making this music.
People are making more sophisticated scripting for their libraries all the time and recording things constantly. And I have friends who do that for a living, and they blow me away with what they do. And composer friends of mine and colleagues, like, for example, you know, Jason Graves, he has invested a huge amount of time and resources into building his own custom sample libraries, which sound outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never really had much interest in that personally. Even though I admire it, and I certainly have a pretty big library of samples that I use, but it really is just for purposes of the mock-ups and facilitating that. You know, I always tell, especially when young composers first getting into it, ask me things like, what kind of libraries do you use? What kind of samples do you use? I always say, look, I'll tell you, but it doesn't actually matter, because all that matters is that the software not get in the way of what you're hoping to say. And if you don't have something to say until the samples give you an idea, then maybe take a step back and reevaluate your process, because if that's how that works, you're going to write to what the samples do as opposed to what music can be. You know, music is a far grander canvas than what samples can do. And a perfect example, a little example, it's a very kind of specific one, but you know, the articulations that strings offer you, for example, are basically short notes and long notes. And to me, the bowing is very important and very specific. And, you know, especially like in the music of Absu, there's a few moments where we have these running figures of this major third doing this. And even just the way I sang that indicates how I hear it. I didn't even do that on purpose, but I'll tell them, okay, I want a very spiccato off the bow sound. Intel beat three, then beat three, that triplet falls under a bowing. So they go, and they bow that all together. Well, to me, you know, to even hope to make the samples do that is hours of work. That's not worth it. But it really does affect the sound and the emotion, I think, pretty tremendously. And also, it's just, even if it's crap music, it's how I hear it anyway. So making no claims as to quality, the final version with the orchestra isn't even just about that it's alive and whatnot. It's that that's the only representation that exists of the actual idea. Because the idea includes all these things that the samples can't or otherwise stubbornly resist doing.
It's going to be so much fun to hear the soundtrack. And as always, it's going to be available to order on Bandcamp. And the thing that I just noticed on your Bandcamp page is that some of the proceeds from the sales of your soundtracks go to LA's Education Through Music, which sounds like an incredible program.
Yeah, thank you for noticing that. I have been on the board of directors. It's called ETMLA, Education Through Music Los Angeles, which is a kind of an offshoot or a franchise almost of what began in New York over 20 years ago, Education Through Music New York, naturally, which is a specific kind of model for music education, which treats music education as one of the pillar subjects of a what we consider to just be a fundamental basic education, and works with schools to implement that as part of the core curriculum. So we started in LA 10 years ago, and I've been on the board for basically that whole time. And we are not, for example, an after-school program. We are not an extracurricular. We work with the principals and say, this needs to be a mandatory. If you want to work with us and our specific model and our specific curricula and things like that, you have to agree that music is not a luxury item and something that we can, you know, fit in for the kids that have the means. And whether that's time, because parents can, you know, make it work to come get them at odd hours or, you know, things like that after school, or obviously resources in the form of needing to get their own instruments and things like that. We say, no. And we also specifically target underserved schools and underserved communities. We don't really go into the Beverly Hills kinds of schools, because often they're fine anyway. They've already got a music program in those. It's the schools that struggle with finance and struggle with attendance and graduation rates and all those kinds of things. Where we feel we're most helpful, because we go in and we add this into the curriculum, and we say to the principals, you know, this needs to be a class that every single kid gets. It cannot be something that is self-selecting for the kids that are most able to get it, because at the end of the day, they're the ones who need it the least. Now, every kid deserves it. I don't care if they're you know, George Lucas's kid growing up in a multi-billion-dollar household, or if they're a kid that is, you know, on the precipice of homelessness. They both equally deserve this. But obviously the George Lucas type children are going to have far easier access to it. So we focus on the underserved schools, figuring that we can do the most good there. So we're serving something like 20,000 kids now. So In any case, another hallmark of the program. First off, it's elementary school focused because early education is where it matters the most. Because of the neuroscience of just when you give music to a very young developing brain, it has a vastly more profound impact than if we're talking about even middle school and high school age kids. Now, of course, it's valuable for everyone, but our idea is we want to be a feeder into middle school and high school music programs of a bunch of kids that have already got a grounding in it. Because the other thing I was going to bring up is that we're a sequential program and we are dogmatically about serving every kid in that school. So most of ours are K-5 or sometimes K-6 elementary schools, where our curriculum is a K-6 curriculum like every other subject, like math, like science, like history, where we are saying you start in kindergarten and first grade builds on the year before, second grade on the year before, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so that by the time they leave, they've actually gotten a proper music education, and not because they sought it out, but because they literally had to. But the results are completely astounding. I mean, cultural transformations of the schools, grades, attendance, all that just starts to soar through the roof, because for a lot of kids, especially kids that really struggle and they have a hard time focusing, or they have a hard time socializing, or they have a hard time making new friends, all those kinds of things, this kind of is this amazing, brilliant catch-all that solves, or at least addresses, the overwhelming number of those problems. I mean, kids actually look forward to coming to school because there's this one subject that they really love. And, you know, playing guitar, or playing violin or cello or recorder or singing, all those things. We do all those things. And then they are able to kind of not associate school with this place that they just can't stand being, or that they feel trapped in, or whatnot. And then they start to do better in all their other subjects. They start to discover things that they like about it there. And you know, I could go on and on and on and on, but it's a really, really important program. I'm very, very thrilled to be involved. And I've got a lot of composer friends and colleagues from the community here in LA that serve on the board with me. And it's a wonderful, to me, it's a very worthwhile use of my time and money every year, because I just think this is tangibly making the world a better place. Evangelizing for education, and hopefully simultaneously both science and reason-based education and the arts as a tangent of that. That's if there's anything that I spend a lot of time on outside of just my career, that's number one. And so I like to use these things as feedback loops on each other. I like to use music as a vehicle for science, and science as a vehicle for music. And my Bandcamp, since that's the question you asked an hour ago, is one way that I do that. And so anyway, I appreciate you taking notice of that and giving me this momentary soapbox.
Well, no, because it is just so important. You cannot overestimate the power of getting a kid excited about music, because it just influences their whole outlook on life. And, you know, music is hard. My son actually crushed his French horn because he got so frustrated.
Oh, wow.
When he was practicing. But he got past that, and he still has this lifelong love of music. And when you especially show kids in underserved areas, like here in Connecticut, in Bridgeport, in New Haven, it really is a life-changing experience for them. So,
yeah, all you have to do is go read Oliver Sacks' book, Musicophilia, and he just loads it full of case studies and all sorts of other evidences for what it does neurologically to young minds to be exposed to music. It's one of the most disproportionately impactful things to do to a young kid's brain. Like as a function of how much effort it takes to bring music into their life relative to the long-term benefits, it should be the most no-brainer imaginable, because it's just, it packs a huge wallop on long-term development. I mean, it's absolutely bizarre and amazing.
Wow, Austin, it has been so much fun to talk with you about this. I mean, I'd love to spend the afternoon, but I'm sure you've got things that you need to take and go and do. But thank you so much for spending some time, and I really enjoyed it.
Oh, the pleasure's mine. I appreciate you indulging all my tangents. I feel like I feel like you basically said, well, tell me what your name is. And somehow I spun off for an hour on random tangents. Needless to say, the pleasure has been all mine.